I'm Mark Roberts, the chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management, and I have the honor of introducing Dr. Dean Burke as our convocation speaker this year. When he steps down next month, Dr. Donald Burke will have been the longest serving dean of the Graduate School of Public Health, holding that position for 14 years. The school that we have now is very different than the school that he came to. We have stronger teaching programs, more high quality research, and an expanded public health practice. We owe a large debt to his accomplishments here at this school. Dr. Burke received his bachelor's degree from the Western Reserve University, his MD degree from Harvard Medical School, completed training in internal medicine at Boston City Hospital and the Massachusetts General Hospital, and then a fellowship in infectious diseases at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He spent 23 years as an active duty officer in the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, where he worked on multiple diseases, including dengue, encephalitis, and HIV, retiring at the rank of colonel. So for some of those of you who have wondered why you always do what he says, that's why. Those silver eagles are still apparent even if he's not in uniform. Dean Burke is an internationally recognized leader in the prevention and control of epidemic infectious diseases of global importance. His scholarly productivity is nothing short of remarkable. He has published more than 300 papers on public health and medicine, which have been cited over 15,000 times. He's a fellow of the American Association of the Advancement of Science, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and is past president of the American Society for Tropical Diseases and Hygiene. He is also an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine. In 2018, he received the John Snow Award from the American Public Health Association and the Royal Society for Public Health in England. When he came to Pittsburgh, he founded the Public Health Dynamics Laboratory, an academic team that develops computational models and simulations of epidemic infectious diseases and other dynamic public health problems, and uses these simulations to evaluate prevention and control strategies. He has championed the use of evidence and computational models to inform decisions in public health and has dramatically enhanced our school's abilities in those areas. Just Google Fred Measles on your smartphone to see an example of his work here. More importantly, Dr. Burke has always directed his work and through his leadership encouraged us to conduct work that matters in people's lives. And that the work that we do as public health researchers and public health practitioners should improve population health. And that's population with a capital P, by which he means the entire population, not just the part of the population covered by a health insurance plan or a health system. He has argued forcefully that our analytic skills and our research and practice expertise should be directed at current, difficult public health problems, most recently, the terrible epidemic of opioids sweeping the nation. Dr. Burke has been responsible for picking our graduation speaker for 14 years, and the list of all the luminaries he has brought to pass on their expertise and advice to you graduating students has been remarkable. But if you were to ask, what speaker could we invite who has had the largest impact on the quality of your education, on the quality of the academic environment in which you conduct research and practice, and do work on matters that are important in people's lives and improve the health of the population, and who has contributed significantly to the improvement of global public health, you could not find a more appropriate speaker than Dean Burke. So by volunteering to be the graduation speaker at his final graduation as dean, he has very clearly saved the best for last. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Burke.
Pull up a chair, it's going to be a long time. Thank you, Professor Roberts, for your kind remarks. I wish my parents were alive to hear that introduction. Mom and Dad would be proud, and they probably would have even believed it. Here today with us are my wife Jane, our daughter Jessie, and her husband Sean, and our granddaughter, Griffin, and our grandson, Warren. Our other daughter, Cassie, is in Boston. I thank my family for their love and support. They know I'm actually an absent-minded professor who wanders around the house in his bathrobe, obsessing over this or that rare book on the history of public health. To members of the graduating class of 2019, I offer you my wholehearted congratulations. Our ceremony today provides an opportunity to pause and reflect on life's transition. This is a joyous event, marking the successful completion of your student days and the commencement of your professional careers. All of us here, your families, partners, friends, and graduate school faculty, join in celebrating your achievements and in wishing you continued future success. I say this as a wizened academic myself, about to step down as dean, who knows a thing or two about transitions. I spent my first quarter century in education and training, my second quarter century in service to my country, my third quarter century in academia, and now I'm figuring out what I want to do for the fourth quarter century. It's been an exciting ride so far. Who knows? Notice that I don't refer to this as my last quarter century. And lucky you, you're just beginning yours. During your education here at the Graduate School of Public Health, you've developed knowledge and skills in the art and science of health. But what is meant by health? The English word health shares its etymologic roots with other words, many of which convey more spiritual concepts, words like hail and whole and holy. All of these words are cognates with common linguistic origins. Similarly, the words for health in other languages that I know, like santé in French or sukapap in Thai, are also cognates with words that convey non-physical aspects of well-being. The French santé shares a common Latin root with the modern English word sanity. In Thailand, the word sukapap for health derives from the Sanskrit word suk, which means happiness. I start with word meanings because the question, what is health, is fundamental for us in the health professions. Today in the United States, most of our medical system focuses heavily on the treatment of disease. I deplore the widely used term health care because it jams the word health into care of the sick. But this is only one dimension of health. The World Health Organization, also known as the WHO, defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Some critics of this WHO definition have assailed it as being too aspirational and unattainable. Critics aside, this definition has taken hold worldwide and serves as the foundation for the work that we do as public health professionals. I much prefer this conceptualization of health as complete physical, mental, and social well-being of the whole person. Pittsburgh has a remarkable connection to this definition of health, as it was originally put forward in the preamble to the Constitution of the WHO in 1946. Our first dean had chaired the Technical Preparatory Committee that drafted that constitution. And the Chinese delegate who chaired the subcommittee on the preamble that includes the WHO definition of health, named Sai Ming-ze, moved to Pittsburgh to spend his elder years with his daughter. His family graciously donated his valuable personal papers on the founding of the WHO to our university archives. I have tracked down most of the historical documents leading up to this WHO definition of health to better understand the intellectual and political origins of such a very modern, very socially aware conceptualization of health. One of our first acts in our newly renovated School of Public Health building was to inscribe this WHO definition of health in bold lettering on the wall facing the entrance of the dean's office. for all to see. All right, if our goal is to promote health, how should we go about it? Over the years, I have collected a set of rules for behavior in the public health workforce, in the workplace. They help me personally decide how to behave in certain circumstances. When encountering a difficult situation, I found it helpful to default to these simple rules to help me make decisions. By sharing them today, I hope they will also help you in your professional life. My modeling collaborator and friend Josh Epstein once wrote an article entitled "Learning to be Thoughtless," in which he pointed out that we all have countless internalized norms that we don't even think about, decisions that we never agonize over. For example, when I got up this morning, I didn't stop to think if I would put on clothes today or not. When I pulled out of the driveway, I didn't stop to think of whether I would drive on the left side or the right side of the road today. The default mode isn't always the optimum, but it usually is, and this way of thinking, or this way of not thinking, of being thoughtless, makes life a whole lot easier. Of course, there is no one single probability, no single threshold for optimizing your routine behaviors. But if the desired outcome can be achieved at least 90% of the time, that makes for pretty good odds. So let's go with what works 90% of the time. Precepts are rules for behavior, for norms that we share and internalize. So here is my set of precepts for public health workplace, expressed as 90% rules. 90% rule number one. 90% of success is showing up. I've enjoyed all my jobs, but there have been inevitably some days and some responsibilities when I'm less enthusiastic, and this rule comes into play. Of course, you have to show up. But showing up means more than just physically coming to class or to work. It means engaging and exploring. By physically getting out of my routine, I've met amazing people who became dear friends, like Dr. Anand Nisalak in Thailand, who taught me about dengue hemorrhagic fever, or Dr. Mpudi Ngole in Cameroon, with whom I ventured into the Congo jungle on our studies of emerging viruses in chimpanzees and gorillas. It's amazing what can happen if you show up and expand your opportunities. 90% rule number two, give 90% of the credit to your coworkers and collaborators. This is a variant of the aphorism, there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. This is probably one of the most valuable workplace rules, but one of the toughest to internalize. Most of you are familiar with the names of famous health science heroes like Pasteur or Salk or Watson and Crick. As you know, Pasteur is credited with the first development of vaccines, and Salk with the conquest of polio, and Watson and Crick with discovery of the helical structure of DNA. But how many of you know the names Joseph Alexander Ozias Terin, or Basil O'Connor, or Rosalind Franklin? These are behind-the-scenes men and women who are also true heroes. Without them, the household name scientists could never have succeeded. I deeply admire these latter three. Sharing credit isn't always easy, but it gets things done. The higher you are in an organization, the more you should share credit. 90% rule number three. There's a lot of these. 90% of meaning can be conveyed in half the words. To this day, I still remember how crestfallen I felt over 40 years ago when my labor of love manuscript on the diagnosis of Japanese encephalitis was returned to me by my friend and mentor, neurology professor Dick Johnson. He had chopped and slashed it mercilessly with red ink. He cut it in half, and he was right. I had tried to force too many extraneous details into the paper to its detriment. This 90% rule also applies to spoken communications. Sometimes when I'm at a meeting and my mind starts to wander, I amuse myself by sketching the meeting dynamics: who speaks the longest, who butts in over other speakers, who repeats themselves. What I've observed, and I'm sure you've observed, is the most valuable contributors are timely and to the point. Most people try to over-discuss. I encourage you to be succinct. 90% rule number four. 90% of perceived insults can be attributed to accidents or indifference. This is one I made up myself, and I use it all the time. Almost all my colleagues who I work with have heard it from me. What it means, of course, is that when you feel insulted by someone, 90% of the time, that person doesn't even realize that you feel that way. It's likely it's not personal and not intentional, so try not to make it so. This rule not only benefits you in that you don't let negative feelings fester, it also has calming effects on the entire organization when everyone applies the rule. Unfortunately, you may encounter some persons who are repeat offenders. In this case, Bayesian statistics does apply. The posterior probabilities change with each occurrence. But the 90% rule should always be your starting default. 90% rule number five. 90% of everything is junk. This is known as Sturgeon's Law, named after the 1950s science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon. The actual quote is actually a bit more scatological than the version I'm giving you today. Sturgeon had grown weary of critics continually lampooning science fiction. In response to a taunt that 90% of science fiction is junk, he shot back, 90% of everything is junk. This may be a bit harsh, but let me explain. Innovation in every field, including public health, is rare, and doing work that is truly outstanding takes creativity and unusual determination. In choosing collaborators, I've always tried to identify and engage with the very best people in the world to work with as partners. And I've always aimed to accept nothing less than outstanding work from my students and colleagues. Strive for excellence. 90% rule number six. 90% of the work is done in the first 90% of the time, and the last 10% of the work is done in the last 90% of the time. This is actually known as the 90-90 rule. It was first derived for work on software development, but I found it to be true in almost every public health project that I've worked on. Be realistic about setting goals and timelines. So to recap, here are my precepts for public health workplace. Show up. 90% of success is showing up. Share credit. Give 90% of the credit to your coworkers and collaborators. Be concise. 90% of meaning can be conveyed in half the words. Chill out. 90% of perceived insults can be attributed to accidents or indifference. Value excellence. 90% of everything is junk. Be realistic. 90% of the work is done in the first 90% of the time, and the last 10% of the work is done in the last 90% of the time. I promise you that if you go with these 90% probabilities 100% of the time, that you will be better public health professionals because of it. And I would venture to say, happier, less stressed out people too. Let me now turn from offering advice to present you with a challenge. During the early days of the AIDS epidemic, Wimbledon tennis champion Arthur Ashe contracted the virus from a blood transfusion during surgery and became deathly ill. In a convocation speech, just like this one, in 1992, the year before he died, he challenged young health graduates. He said, "Like it or not, the world is looking to you for the answers." I began working on AIDS in the epidemic and kept that quote posted above my desk for years. Somehow his words affected me deeply, and I worked hard, doing everything I could to prevent and control the spreading epidemic of HIV and AIDS. It became more than a job. It became a mission, even a calling. I felt that because of my training and expertise, I personally carried a measure of responsibility to come up with the answers like it or not. So now I'm passing on this challenge to you. Your generation will have the opportunity to control the opioid epidemic, to end gun violence, to improve birth outcomes, to prevent cancer, to reduce health disparities, to provide care for mental illness, and to promote healthy aging, to name just a few of the challenges in public health. The world will be looking to you for the answers. I know you can do it. You have shown that you have incredible potential. You have the potential to improve health in all of its dimensions, the physical and the mental and the social. You have the potential to be transformational leaders in the public health workplace and in society at large. And yes, you have the potential to change the world for the better. We at Pitt Public Health have done our best to prepare you for these challenges. I'm confident that you will make the most of it. Thank you for your attention. Now let me conclude with my most important message. Class of 2019, congratulations as you commence your careers in public health. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.